What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care, so sit back, relax, and defocus.
Today's podcast is in partnership with Optometry Times.
Well, hello, Defocus Media listeners. We are back in 2019, and you know, January always kicks off with Glaucoma Awareness Month. And the last few years, Daryl and I have been really focused. Each month, we want to bring you the latest up-to-date discussion about glaucoma when it's time for us to really focus on the disease at the beginning of the year. On this podcast today, this is a full glaucoma update, and we're going a little outside of optometry and ophthalmology and focusing on a researcher in the field. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Cynthia Steele.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, because you are a PhD and your subject body, I've heard you described a couple different ways, but when you first introduced me, they said you're a PhD in trabecular meshwork, but break that down a little bit for us.
Yes, I am. So again, my name is Cynthia Steele. I have a PhD technically from the Department of Cell Biology and Anatomy from Loyola University in Chicago. Currently, full disclosure, I am what they call a glaucoma medical science liaison at Bausch & Lomb, but in my previous life, I was a glaucoma researcher for about 10 years. And really, I just got interested in glaucoma back in 2005 because at that time I had joined a lab that was interested in treating different peripheral neuropathies with cholesterol-lowering statin drugs. Now, around that time, people were getting very interested in statins because they were shown to have a lot of other effects in the body, independent of cholesterol. And these were called pleiotropic effects. And so researchers were getting really interested in learning more about that. And so the lab that I was working in at the time was interested in the anti-inflammatory effects that statins might have on a couple of different neuropathies, including glaucoma. And so then my first project was actually helping a postdoc there work on her project, which was looking at statins and in the treatment and prevention of retinal ganglion cell death in a model of acute glaucoma.
Wow. And I mean, just out of curiosity, did you guys find that it had any effect?
Unfortunately, not really. But what we believe was the problem is this was a rat model of acute glaucoma that had an extremely high pressure component. This involved basically jacking up the eye pressure to really high levels. I mean, using a tonometer, we were measuring pressure somewhere in the 70s for about an hour. Normal baseline pressure in a rat was about 13 or 14, so similar to humans. And the pressure would be that high, the eye would actually blanch for about an hour, and then you'd bring the pressure back down. So what we believed was that it was just too high pressure of a model. It was maybe like taking a sledgehammer to the retina when maybe we should have been doing something a little bit gentler.
Daryl, what would you do if you had a patient with an IOP of 70 in your chair?
I'll probably faint. No, let me stop. Simply, you know, I'll drop down the pressure in the eye and then get them out to a specialist so that they can look into it in a little more detail. But 70?
Yeah,
man,
you know,
that's crazy.
Well, one of the things that's actually a limitation of glaucoma research is the lack of really good animal models. You know, I can get into this a little bit more later, but really, as far as your standard primary open-angle glaucoma, very chronic disease, low pressure that slowly builds over time, there's a small, small handful of models. And the problem is, especially if you are working with animal models, that takes a long time to develop. And that can cost a lot of money. That can take a lot of patience. If you're a PhD student, maybe you don't have a year or 2 years to wait for this model to develop. So you have to look for something that's very quick and very acute. But when you do that, then you're limiting yourself. You know, it's not a true glaucoma model. It's not truly physiological. So it's really a toss-up one way or the other, you know, and it depends on what your priority is.
So what other hurdles or obstacles have you encountered with being a PhD?
So unfortunately, there really are a lot of hurdles to getting funding for glaucoma research. There are some fantastic foundations out there, like the Glaucoma Research Foundation and the Glaucoma Foundation, that are not-for-profits that fund a lot of glaucoma research. Full disclosure, the Glaucoma Research Foundation did fund me for a year of my work prior to me switching to industry. But really, unfortunately, it seems like the era of doing science just because it's cool and you have a really interesting question that you want to answer, that's kind of fallen by the wayside because people really want to fund cures. And as a PhD student, as a postdoc that's maybe working with a relatively small group, that's a really tall order, you know? And some of my most frustrating days were getting grant reviews that said, we don't see how this is going to lead lead to a cure for glaucoma. Now it's a, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that that was my job. You know, I didn't realize that I was the only person out there that was working on this, you know? So that's really one hard thing is, and a lot of it is who you know and who you work with, but also, you know, it's, as researchers, we all find our one piece of the puzzle that we're very interested in, whether it's one specific protein or one specific gene or a cell, you know, and understanding how that you are only fixing one piece of the puzzle. You're putting in one or two pieces. And in the broad picture, you need the entire group of people, everyone nationwide who's working on it, to actually make a difference. And so, unfortunately, I think that one of the biggest hurdles that I found was just trying to convince people that my particular little piece of the puzzle was worth the funds and was worth the investment. And then again, as I mentioned, the other really big hurdle was not really having any good glaucoma models. I mean, there are excellent models if you want to study macular degeneration, if you want to study diabetic retinopathy. I mean, there's a lot of good models for other diseases like that. But glaucoma still remains very tricky because it's such a chronic disease. And you guys know better than I do, it's caused by a myriad of different factors. And so it depends on the patient and it depends on each individual situation. So that ultimately is kind of what made me start to switch gears and look into other options and, you know, start getting into industry.
And then that's so frustrating, Daryl, when we think about, because I think as doctors, we can truly understand our understanding and knowledge of glaucoma is very low, especially when we compare it to a disease process like that, like macular degeneration, that we still don't really fully understand there either. We have so much more research just to get to the bottom of what is happening in glaucoma. It seems like asking for a cure from research is so far down the road, it's even hard to fathom that that could be something that would be demanded. But the world we live in, you know, research costs money. And the only thing that brings monetary return is, you know, a new treatment or a new drug that a healthcare system can help support.
Amen. You said it better than I could.
Well, through your research on this project, obviously you got into glaucoma. And then, of course, a vital part of understanding glaucoma is understanding the anterior segment. Mm-hmm. And the trabecular meshwork is a huge component of that and so important when we talk about what's happening in the glaucoma disease process. But I want to hear it from your perspective. What was it about anterior segment and trabecular meshwork in particular that really inspired so much interest for you?
So the trabecular meshwork, these cells are like no other cells in the body. You know, people ask me this question all the time, why the TM? And I always respond, why not the TM? They're such interesting little cells, you know? So in short, they're endothelial-like cells. You know, they're shaped like endothelial cells. They're derived, I think, from the same developmental tissue as endothelial cells. They, however, contract like smooth muscle cells do. They produce their own extracellular matrix like fibroblasts do, but they also are phagocytic like macrophages. So that allows them to be like a self-cleaning filter. And it was utterly fascinating to me to learn that this drainage passage in the eye that I was just learning about, and maybe it took up a sentence or two in a textbook that I was reading, that there's so much more to it. There are these cells in there that maintain themselves. You know, they maintain the entire tissue. And as long as those cells are alive and viable, you're still going to have a good, viable, conventional outflow pathway. And so that's really what got me interested. And especially like early in the mid-2000s, I would say people really were starting getting interested in how could you modify the actin cytoskeleton? How can you modify trabecular meshwork cells in order to lower pressure in glaucoma? That was right around the time that you guys might remember that really the prostaglandin wars were kicking in the early to mid-2000s. People were so excited that they finally had a drug that was going to increase aqueous outflow, but there was a small group of people out there saying, that's great, but that's not the problem. The uveal scleral pathway is not the problem. It's the trabecular meshwork. And I just found it so fascinating that this really tiny wedge of tissue, relatively speaking, in the eye was causing such a big problem. And I just wanted to know more. And even to this day, I always want to know more. I'm actually a member of what they call the Trabecular Meshwork Study Club. We had a meeting a few weeks ago. And this is all we do. We sit around for two straight days and we talk about our newest research, what's up and coming, patient perspective, perspectives, everything, all related to the trabecular meshwork. It is fascinating.
So since Jen and I are not cool enough to be a part of this club, what are some of the newest things and trends discussed at the Trabecular Meshwork Study Club?
Well, so this is not my research. Unfortunately, since I work in industry now, I'm no longer doing research. But really, speaking from my perspective as a trabecular meshwork cell biologist, we understand that dysfunction in the trabecular meshwork is really the key cause of why IOP goes up in the first place. And what's getting really fascinating to me is learning more about how that tissue regulates itself in terms of pressure. So we're learning more, and there are researchers out there working on this right now, on how the trabecular meshwork itself senses changes in intraocular pressure. So trabecular meshwork cells have what they call mechanosensors, or little sensors on their cell surface that can detect changes in pressure. Like, they can experience changes in compression. They can experience stretch. Schlemm's canal cells can experience an increase in shear stress, all as a result of changes in intraocular pressure. And then those cells can compensate. That triggering these sensors can lead to changes in gene expression, changes in extracellular matrix production, changes in the cytoskeleton. And I am just utterly fascinated in learning more, again, about how this tissue kind of regulates itself. It doesn't just clean itself, but it also can maintain its own IOP homeostasis. Now, the follow-up question to that, of course, is, well, then what happens in glaucoma? And that's, to the best of my knowledge, that's still something that people are looking into. But as I understand it, it seems like what's really happening is, over time, the trabecular meshwork becomes stiffer. You know, more extracellular matrix is being laid down. And if you imagine, I'm going to describe to your listeners for a second, the trabecular meshwork is like a sieve, and the bone structure, for lack of a better word, the structure of the meshwork itself, what gives it its rigidity is extracellular matrix, like collagen, fibronectin being some of the biggest components. Also, it has some elastic components to it, and those cells sit on those beams and produce that extracellular matrix. And so it's my understanding that over time, as the cells produce more extracellular matrix, and maybe it doesn't get digested as much, it doesn't get remodeled as much, that whole system can become stiffer. And when the bones become stiffer, for lack of a better term, when the bones become stiffer, the cells have less of an ability to detect those changes. They're not going to experience the same amount of stretch or the same amount of compression. And that can cause dysregulation of the whole system. And so what really gets me excited is thinking about what else we can do to target trabecular meshwork early. What can we do in early treatment of glaucoma, maybe to restore homeostasis through the trabecular meshwork? The other thing that is really, really exciting to me is to think of the importance of aqueous humor in the health of the trabecular meshwork. So a lot of people don't know that aqueous humor is actually what I like to call a blood surrogate for trabecular meshwork cells. So the TM itself does not have a blood supply, you know, and you guys know as doctors that if you see blood in the anterior segment, it's generally a bad thing. So, when the TM needs nutrients, the place where it's going to get it from is the aqueous. So aqueous humor is very high in carbohydrate, very high in ascorbate, very high in protein. And you can imagine that if outflow through the TM becomes restricted, either because the cells are too contracted or those beams of extracellular matrix have become too thick and everything's less pliable, what you end up with is less exposure to good, healthy aqueous humor. And then that can ultimately trigger almost like a downward spiral. You have less flow through the TM. You're getting less nutrients to those deeper tissues, you know, the deeper cells in the trabecular meshwork. This is a multi-layered structure, you know, so those deeper cells are going to be the ones that suffer first. And if you have cell stress, you could eventually get cell death. And really, that's when you start getting real problems with glaucoma, because now the system can't regulate itself at all. So this is a concept that I still find completely fascinating. And I think we're just hitting the tip of the iceberg now in terms of research and in terms of therapeutics with it.
I totally agree. You know, last year was a big year for glaucoma. There were a lot of new medications that were introduced to the market. There were a lot of great correlation studies. And then also I saw a lot of emphasis on lifestyle and nutrition. What are your thoughts in regards to nutrition and lifestyle when it comes to reducing glaucoma?
Well, sure. So, I mean, you guys know probably better than I do that some of the best things you can tell your patients to do is to stop smoking, wear sunglasses, you know, take a multivitamin. You know, these are easy things that you can do to preserve your vision. There was a fascinating study that came out a few years ago as part of the Nurses' Health Study showing that consumption of green leafy vegetables leads to an increase in dietary nitrates. So I should put it this way. Green leafy vegetables are an excellent source of dietary nitrates. And so increased consumption of those vegetables could actually lead to protection from glaucoma. And they believe that that is because you have increased dietary nitrates means you have more production of nitric oxide, which is a vasodilator. And so that actually can lead to not only improved IOP homeostasis possibly, but just vasodilation and improved blood flow. And so unfortunately, that does mean that you have to try to encourage your patients to eat their kale or maybe throw some spinach in their smoothie, which is a lot less fun than some other things. But definitely there are some nutritional things that patients can do. Antioxidants, for sure. You know, the trabeculomastric cells being as important as they are, anything to protect the mitochondria is a good thing. I know people talk about resveratrol, people talk about ginkgo biloba. There was some really interesting studies that came out of New York looking at this B vitamin derivative called nicotinamide. And nicotinamide was also shown to be neuroprotective as well. So independently of the trabecular meshwork, people, of course, are interested in neuroprotection in glaucoma. I mean, we understand that that's the end all be all when it comes to glaucoma. And that's really the hard part, because I could talk about protecting the TM all day long, but what you guys are worried about is the thing that you can control, the thing that you can treat, which is intraocular pressure. And if you can get the pressure down, we know that every millimeter of mercury leads to a 10 to 20% visual field preservation. And so I completely understand that there are some times that you just need to get the pressure down by whatever means possible in order to protect vision. But hopefully one day the day will come that we will have a treatment modality, either in the form of an antioxidant or a pharmacological agent, that can be neuroprotective as well as preserving health of the TM. That would be like the holy grail, in my opinion.
I think this is so exciting because we're talking about a paradigm shift, really, in how we're thinking about glaucoma. So, Daryl, this reminds me so much of DEWS 2 coming out earlier in the previous year and redefining dry eye as the loss of tear film homeostasis. So now we're talking about, you know, in past, in glaucoma, of course, because the only thing we can treat is eye pressure, it's always so focused on let's lower eye pressure to help preserve and protect the nerve, right? But if we kind of shift that model to say, no, let's focus on restoring IOP homeostasis, and that's just a totally different mindset for doctors, and how we go about achieving that might look completely different.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
So are there any treatment modalities that you feel might become outdated as time goes on when we think about things like SLT or surgeries that would actually potentially be damaging?
So I don't know much about SLT and some of the surgical modalities, admittedly. I do know, though, that most people don't believe that SLT is really damaging to the TM. I think, as I understand it, the idea behind SLT is to give enough of a, I won't call it a heat shock, but enough of a stimulus to the TM to trigger some of that phagocytic action that TM cells naturally have. And so if they experience like a low amount of stress or a low amount of inflammation, then that could maybe kick in a little bit more of that self-cleaning filter function. So the TM cells might actually ingest more and be able to digest more of that extracellular matrix or anything that might be coming through that's obscuring outflow. The other treatment modalities, certainly. I mean, anything that cuts out the TM, you know that you need some sort of antifibrotic agent as a follow-up in order to stop your scleral fibroblasts from taking over and closing up the hole. Now, we do know, this is another interesting part of research coming forward, is this concept of distal outflow as well. So everyone generally understands that you can't largely get pressures down below 8 or 9, which, as I understand it, is episcleral venous pressure. And so people are learning that there may actually be some resistance to aqueous outflow distal to the trabecular meshwork, like at the level of Schlumpf's canal, the collector channels, you know, tissues that are much further out. And so this is another example where for the longest time we said the TM is the only place where there's resistance to aqueous outflow. And that paradigm is changing too. So 2019 and 2020 could be some really interesting years in terms of research and what we find out and how we're able to target not only the trabecular meshwork, but the tissues even further down. So in terms of surgical modalities, as I understand it, SLT is the safest of the laser treatments, certainly burning holes in the trabecular meshwork. I mean, it brings a tear to my eye, you know, but also I just don't think it's probably not the best option. Something better to do would be to try to keep the tissue intact as much as possible for as long as you can, you know? So if the cells, I guess this is the problem with some of these treatment modalities, you know, if you wait too long, if a patient has developed glaucoma for a long enough time and the trabecular meshwork is already compromised, unfortunately at that point, there's really not much that you can do. You know, those cells are not going to respond to treatment. To quote one of my favorite movies, The Princess Bride, I always say, oh, those TM cells are only mostly dead, you know? If they're mostly dead, you can do something about it. But if they're all dead, well, there's only one thing you can do with all dead, you know? And so in that case, I can understand why some people would say, you know what, this tissue is not working. It's not viable. Let's see what happens if we just take some pieces out. Let's try to get to the viable tissue, maybe some tissue that's still in there. You know, so I can understand that modality, but, you know, time will tell whether early treatment and early modification of the trabecular meshwork actually leads to improved functional outcome over time. And again, that's something that I'm really excited to keep an eye out for in the future.
Wow, that's great insight. I would love to get your perspective on topical drops. I mean, what are your thoughts in regards to that as far as treatment goes?
Even in the early 90s, people were wondering about not so much the efficacy, but the safety of slowing aqueous production. So if we go back to this concept of aqueous humor being a blood surrogate for trabecular meshwork cells, people have been questioning for a long time whether it's a good idea to be slowing aqueous production. You know, I use the sink analogy all the time. It's understandable that if you have a clog in the drain, the first thing that you're going to do is turn down the faucet. But the best thing for you to do would be to open up the drain, especially if that drain is not just a piece of pipe, but is actually a viable tissue that's relying on the water. You know, so I would also say that over time, I hope that we use some of these aqueous suppressants as maybe a tertiary or quaternary option rather than a primary or secondary. Yeah, and that, I will say, that is just my opinion as a trabecular meshwork cell nerd, not as a representative of any company or any modality.
Wow, great information, great show. Thank you so much for being a part of the Defocus Media Podcast today, Dr. Steele. For our listeners, our followers that want to learn more about the TM and just pick your brain, what's the best way for them to contact you?
Cynthia Steele. If people want to get in touch with me through LinkedIn, I'm perfectly happy to answer more questions and talk more about the TM. I'm always happy to do that.
Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast. And remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.